So, have you ever read a completely logical, beautifully written investigative report, but still felt like, I don't know, something was just fundamentally wrong with it?
Oh, absolutely. Like, you read the timeline and it's flawless. The witness summaries align perfectly.
Right.
The conclusion just feels totally bulletproof, and yet your gut is telling you it's a complete fabrication.
Yeah, exactly. And not because anyone outright lied necessarily, but because the whole document reads less like a genuine search for the truth and, well, much more like a defense strategy, you know?
Right, a strategy built to justify a decision that was already made long before the very first interview even happened.
Which is such an unsettling feeling. And if you are an HR professional or legal counsel, or really just someone fascinated by how institutions work, you've probably encountered this. So today we are doing a deep dive into a massive stack of sources to figure out how this actually happens.
We really are. We're looking at federal appellate decisions, internal audit guidelines, and this really fascinating foundational framework developed by civil rights attorney Eric Sanders.
Yeah, his work is incredible. And our mission today is to unpack this phenomenon called evidentiary inversion. So we want to provide a masterclass on conducting neutral, fact-based internal investigations, spotting hidden biases, and ensuring that disciplinary records can actually withstand ultimate judicial or legal scrutiny.
Which is huge, because understanding evidentiary inversion requires a complete paradigm shift in how we view the investigative process. I mean, the whole purpose of an investigation is to begin with uncertainty.
Right, like you shouldn't know the answer yet.
Exactly. A situation occurs, the facts are messy, accounts conflict, and the investigator's job is to wade into that mess and figure out what actually happened. But in evidentiary inversion, the timeline is completely flipped.
The conclusion comes first.
Yes, the institution decides someone is a problem, and the investigation just becomes an administrative machine. It's designed solely to produce a written record that justifies that pre-selected outcome.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because to really spot where an investigation goes off the rails, we first have to understand what the correct sequence of building a record actually looks like.
Right, the life cycle of a normal investigation.
Yeah, exactly. Like if you look at standard audit guidelines, a healthy investigation always builds forward. You start in the mud, basically. You gather raw facts, you test competing accounts, you interview the central witnesses.
Especially the ones who might completely blow up your initial theory.
Right. You have to actively seek out exculpatory evidence. You only reach a conclusion after the record is fully developed. That's building forward.
And an inverted investigation runs the exact opposite way. It builds backward from the destination.
Because they already know where they want to end up.
Exactly. The institution selects an outcome. Like, maybe leadership wants to terminate a whistleblower who is bringing up uncomfortable safety issues,
Yeah.
or they want to protect a favorite manager who crossed a line. From that moment, the inquiry narrows. The investigator curates the evidence, capturing only what supports the goal and literally discarding what doesn't. And then they draft a disciplinary charge specifically to fit that highly curated, deeply flawed record.
I want to focus on the human element here for a second,
Right.
especially for new investigators or HR staff who might be under internal pressure. Because, I mean, investigators rarely set out to be villains.
Almost never.
If I am a new HR investigator, I'm not waking up in the morning planning to rig a case and ruin someone's career. So why did they fall into this bias trap without even realizing it?
Well, it's rarely some comic book level malice. It's actually a really subtle psychological gravity called institutional expectation.
Institutional expectation. Okay, how does that work?
So, evidentiary inversion usually takes root before the investigator even opens a file. It starts when the institution just casually defines an event through a preferred lens.
Give me an example.
Okay, so an employee makes a protected safety disclosure, right? But in management meetings, it's casually discussed as disloyalty. Or a manager refusing an illegal directive is suddenly labeled uncooperative.
I see. So the label is already applied.
Exactly. Once leadership adopts that lens, everybody understands the desired result. The investigator understands what their boss wants. The boss understands what executive leadership expects.
And the filtering just begins automatically.
Yes, entirely unconsciously. The investigator isn't explicitly told to frame anyone. They're just operating in an environment where the conclusion is treated as gravity.
It's like it's the equivalent of painting a bullseye around an arrow that has already been shot. You walk up to the target, draw the rings perfectly around the arrow, step back, and declare you have perfect aim.
That's a perfect analogy.
The final picture looks perfectly accurate, but the entire game was rigged from the start.
Right. And the tools used to paint that bullseye are exactly what reviewing counsel and auditors need to understand. Because investigators aren't using magic, you know. They're using very specific administrative mechanics to curate the file.
So what are the mechanics? If the bullseye is painted after the fact, exactly what tools is the investigator using? I was reading through the audit guidelines in our stack, and they talk about something called scope control.
Oh, scope control is huge. It's essentially the art of wearing blinders.
Right.
The agency defines the investigation just tightly enough to sustain a disciplinary charge, but narrowly enough to avoid any exculpatory context.
So they zoom in so close you can't see the big picture.
Exactly. Like if an employee is accused of sending an unauthorized email, the scope is restricted to proving just whether they sent the email. It explicitly walls off investigating why they sent it or whether sending it was legally protected whistleblowing.
Wow. And the investigator can just claim they were staying on topic while entirely missing the actual truth.
Yep. And that pairs directly with another tool called selective documentation. This is when witness interviews are distilled into written memos, but the distillation removes all the friction.
Okay, I have to push back on this a little bit because isn't an investigator's job to summarize?
Well, yes, but...
I mean, if I'm an HR rep taking a witness statement, I can't transcribe every single tangent, every and our doubt the witness expresses. The file would be 10,000 pages long. It would be totally unreadable. How do I know I'm not accidentally selectively documenting?
That is such a great point, and this nuance is so important. The distinction lies in preserving the core truth of the witness's experience. Summarizing shortens the story, sure, but selective documentation replaces the witness's voice with what the sources call institutional language masquerading as testimony.
Institutional language masquerading as testimony. That sounds intense.
It is. When you summarize ethically, you preserve the witness's doubts, their hesitation, their actual observations. But in an inverted record, you see witness accounts written in this polished, command-friendly jargon that sounds nothing like a real human being.
Okay, so instead of a witness saying, like, I couldn't really hear what was happening, it was loud and chaotic, but Jim seemed upset, the final report reads something like, the witness confirmed the employee's behavior was highly disruptive and actively undermined departmental operations.
Spot on. The human uncertainty is totally scrubbed out. It's replaced by a clean, surgical sentence that neatly supports the agency's theory.
Wow.
And the danger here is that the final record contains institutional conclusions rather than the concrete observations that led to those conclusions, which feeds directly into this overarching process known as narrative laundering.
Narrative laundering. Like money laundering, but for facts.
Exactly like that. You scrub the facts clean so they look legitimate on paper. A manager's personal anger that an employee filed a grievance is laundered into a formal operational impact concern.
Right. So by the time it reaches formal review, the original retaliatory motive is completely invisible. It's hidden behind layers of administrative jargon. The facts that don't fit are ignored, and witnesses who might disagree are officially deemed, you know, unnecessary to the scope of the inquiry.
But laundering the facts is really only step one, because for an institution to actually discipline or fire someone, human resources needs a rulebook violation. They have to force these cleaned up facts into official policy.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because once the narrative is laundered, the institution needs an official container to hold it. And when an agency lacks concrete evidence, they can't use specific charges, right?
Right. If you accuse an employee of falsifying a compliance ledger, you have to produce the ledger. You have to actually prove they altered it. There's a tangible burden of proof.
So to make these laundered narratives stick, institutions rely on elastic disciplinary charges.
Yes. They use these vague containers, terms like poor judgment, lack of professionalism, conduct unbecoming, or my personal favorite, loss of public confidence.
Right, because the weaker the evidence, the broader the language becomes.
Exactly. Specificity exposes a flawed investigation. Generality conceals it. When you charge someone with poor judgment, well, the definition of judgment rests entirely in the eye of the agency.
Which creates a severe structural problem, right? Like this trap of circular logic. How does an auditor or legal counsel even spot the red flags of that circular logic?
Okay, so circular charging happens when an agency treats the mere existence of the charge as the proof that the conduct was wrongful.
Wait, run that by me again.
So the agency claims the employee's conduct was improper because it violated standards of judgment. And how do we know it violated standards of judgment? Because the agency concluded the conduct was improper.
Oh, wow. So the proof never leaves the circle.
Never. The discipline is justified because the conduct was labeled improper, and it was labeled improper to justify the discipline.
That is wild. And I imagine making that circular logic hold up requires investigators to do a lot of context scripting.
Ugh, an aggressive amount. In inverted investigations, context is treated as a severe threat, because context usually provides the difference between misconduct and protected conduct.
Right. Let's think about an example. Consider an employee who makes a protected disclosure about severe workplace safety violations to an outside regulator.
In a neutral investigation, the context is workplace safety and whistleblower protection. That's the lens.
But in an inverted investigation, the agency strips that context away entirely. The safety concern is omitted from the file, and the act is reframed simply as a confidentiality breach.
Exactly. Once you strip the context, literally any action can be framed as misconduct.
So for HR professionals listening, the big takeaway here is that ensuring all investigative documentation remains contextually complete, including the why and the circumstances around an event, is the absolute only way to avoid this trap. You have to document the context, even if it deeply complicates management's preferred narrative.
You absolutely do. And knowing how this trap is set actually gives us the blueprint for taking it apart.
Right. Because if you are a neutral third party, like reviewing legal counsel or an external HR auditor, how do you actually audit an investigation for this hidden bias?
Yeah.
I mean, you are reading a file that has already been polished and laundered. It looks professional. What breaks the illusion?
Well, a manufactured record usually announces itself through omissions.
Let's create a mental checklist for the listener right now to use when reviewing an investigative file.
Love that. Okay. The absolute biggest diagnostic sign, the number one red flag you can look for, is the absent central witness.
The missing central witness checklist.
Yes, you have to ask. If the core allegation turns on what was said in a meeting, was the recipient of those words actually interviewed? If the agency claims an employee caused a massive disruption to the workplace, is the person claiming they were impacted actually examined on the record?
Right. Is the person claiming impact examined? And the critical question the auditor must ask is why that witness is missing.
Exactly. Did the agency fail to get the best evidence because it was truly unavailable? Like maybe the person left the company and refused to return calls? Or did they fail to get it because interviewing that witness was dangerous to their pre-selected theory?
Yeah, if an investigation interviews five peripheral coworkers who heard rumors in the break room, but miraculously fails to interview the one person who was actually in the room when the event occurred, you are looking at a manufactured record.
Exactly. Another crucial item on that auditor checklist is shifting theories.
Shifting theories. What does that look like?
This happens when the initial accusation falls apart, but instead of dropping the case, the agency just changes the accusation to fit whatever evidence they have left.
Ah, okay. So a case starts as a concrete falsification of records violation, but then IT logs prove the employee didn't alter anything.
Right. And instead of clearing the employee, the agency suddenly shifts the charge to an appearance of impropriety case.
Mm-hmm.
The employee is forced to defend a constantly moving target.
That's incredibly frustrating. And what about comparators? The sources talk about missing comparators.
Yes, auditors need to look for that too. If the agency claims an employee showed poor judgment, a neutral investigation must ask how other employees in similar situations were treated.
Have other employees committed similar infractions?
Right. Were they fired or were they just given a verbal warning? A manufactured record avoids comparators entirely because comparing how favored employees are treated exposes the underlying motive of the investigation.
But I mean, any one of these things could just be a sloppy mistake, right? An investigator might genuinely forget to pull comparable cases, or they might run out of time to interview a central witness before a deadline.
What's fascinating here is a convergence of these flaws. Because yes, one missing witness is a mistake, but when you have a missing central witness, moving alongside shifting theories, paired with missing comparators, wrapped in vague elastic charges, and written in highly polished institutional language.
Wow. Yeah, when you put it like that.
When all those separate choices move in the exact same direction, the explanation of coincidence becomes totally implausible. It is a method, not a mistake.
And when that method is used to terminate an employee, the stakes move from just internal HR policy to fundamental constitutional rights.
They really do.
So what happens when an HR department finalizes one of these flawed inverted records? An employee sues, and this perfectly polished, fundamentally flawed record hits the legal system.
This is where we have to look at the legal fault lines, specifically precedents like Loudermill and Ricciuti. Due process fails entirely when records are manufactured.
Let's break those down. Loudermill first.
So Loudermill established that public employees have a property interest in their jobs. To translate that, the law basically treats your job as something you legally own, meaning the government cannot just take it away without giving you meaningful notice and a fair opportunity to respond.
But if the record is manufactured, they aren't getting meaningful notice. If they're handed a charge built from stripped context and omitted witnesses, a hearing only works if the employee is responding to a neutral allegation. Here, they're responding to a narrative designed to conceal its own weaknesses. They are fighting a ghost.
And that connects directly to Ricciuti, which recognized the constitutional danger of government actors fabricating evidence. While Ricciuti was a criminal case, the principle applies to administrative law. The government cannot use its official authority to create a materially distorted record that causes legal injury.
Because a half-truth can be as damaging as a total lie when the omitted half is the very context that proves innocence.
Exactly.
So the system is broken at the agency level, but doesn't the court fix it? I mean, the whole point of judicial review is to catch these things, right?
You would think so, but the sources refer to this as the two-stage distortion model, and it is probably the most concerning failure of administrative law.
Two-stage distortion. Okay, what's stage one?
Stage one occurs when the agency builds the record backward, curating the evidence to fit the conclusion. We've talked about that.
Why?
Stage two occurs when the reviewing court reads the record forward, applying what is called arbitrary and capricious review.
Okay, arbitrary and capricious review. That's basically a fancy legal way of saying the judge is only checking if the agency's decision was completely random or if they had at least some baseline logic written down, right?
Right.
The court is actively deferring to the agency.
Yes. The court looks at the file. They see it's beautifully formatted. They see witness summaries. They see formal charges. And they just assume it is complete. The court mistakes the completeness of the paperwork for the completeness of the proof.
Oh.
If the court only asks the baseline question like, is there some evidence in this file to support firing this person? Well, the agency wins every time. Because, of course, there is evidence in the file. They specifically curated the file to include only the evidence that supports their decision.
Man. The agency's strategic omission becomes the court's limitation. The court is reviewing the manufactured product without ever actually auditing the production line.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, deference to an agency's expertise is only appropriate when the agency has actually engaged in reasoned, neutral fact-finding. A court should not defer to an agency's credibility determination if that determination was built on missing witnesses and unexamined contradictions.
So for legal counsel representing an organization or reviewing a file before it goes to a judge, what is the advice here? How do you ensure judicial reviews do not just validate distorted facts? How do you audit that production line?
Counsel absolutely must stop looking only at the final product. You have to ask the threshold question. Was this record built in a way that excluded the facts necessary to make a rational decision?
How do you find that out?
You demand draft reports, internal emails, Teams messages, prior versions of the disciplinary charge. Look at the metadata.
Oh, the metadata?
Yes. When did the investigator first conclude there was misconduct? Was it before they even interviewed the key witness? You have to audit the process of record construction, not just read the final narrative. Deference belongs to lawful fact-finding, not to a curated story.
So what does this all mean? Let's synthesize this for you, the listener, whether you are building these files or auditing them. If you are an HR staff member investigating a workplace incident, your process must start with facts, not conclusions.
Right.
You must build forward, gathering the messy reality before forming a theory. And if you are an auditor, HR director, or legal counsel reviewing an agency record, your job is to evaluate the process of construction, not just the polished final product.
Exactly. Hunt for the omissions. Look for elastic charges like conduct unbecoming that lack concrete proof.
Run the checklist for the missing central witness. Watch for narrative laundering, where a manager's personal annoyance is just magically transformed into operational disruption.
Because institutional consistency, you know, having a file that reads perfectly smoothly from start to finish, is absolutely not a substitute for evidentiary integrity.
A flawlessly written file might just be the bullseye painted around the arrow. It looks perfect, but it is fundamentally dishonest.
I want to leave you with a final thought to ponder. Something that takes this entire problem and scales it into the future.
Okay, let's hear it.
We've talked a lot about human investigators laundering narratives and courts deferring to those perfectly polished files. But consider what happens next. Artificial intelligence models are currently being trained on decades of these flawlessly written, perfectly laundered internal HR reports to help automate future investigations.
Oh, wow.
If these files are filled with hidden bias and context stripping, are we about to automate, scale, and permanently bake this exact same evidentiary inversion into the future of human resources? If an institution defines its reality through the paperwork it creates, and courts defer to that paperwork as truth, does the truth even exist outside the file? The next time you read a flawless, perfectly consistent report, ask yourself, what had to be deleted to make this story so perfect?
That is a terrifying thought. Automating the magic trick so it happens at lightning speed. Keep asking the hard questions, look past the paperwork, and we'll catch you on the next deep dive into the source material.